So this week we no new iOS betas for the developer side, but we got the public betas for everybody. So iOS 12, tvOS 12, and macOS Mojave. tvOS and iOS on Monday, and Mojave on Tuesday. Always a little bit later. Interestingly, so with the iOS 12 beta, the public beta. It's just as we discussed in recent episodes, you know, where I had a better experience with public beta, with beta one, developer beta one, then developer beta two, and then public beta one is developer beta two. So I wouldn't recommend it yet, and like I wouldn't put it on like family's devices. It's kind of my test. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'd never put betas on the family's devices just so I couldn't get the blame for it.
Yeah,
you don't even text even if there are problems, completely unrelated to the beta, it'll be, you put this stupid thing on my phone, what would you do that for? But yeah, like I would never, I put all the dev betas on my personal stuff, but even this year when, you know, it's probably more solid than years past, I would never put it on too soon. Just in, like, other people don't have as good backups in case stuff goes wrong and weirdness they can't, you know, circumvent or get around. Like on my watch, I do like a 30-minute workout every day. And with the watchOS 5 beta, I think somehow related to the automatic pause features, the workouts keep stopping, like, of their own accord. So the auto-detection pause is just supposed to suggest you that it pauses. And, you know, with, like, a notification, you can actually confirm it. But something weird is happening where I, like, stop for a second and have a drink while I'm, you know, running or whatever. And then I go back and it, like, the UI for the workout app just kind of glitches out and it just stops recording information. The timer stops and you can't really do anything but start over. And then it saves the data to like that 25 minutes. But then in the last few days, because I try and do 30 minutes every day, I have like one 25 minute workout and then one 6 minute workout that I've done straight after just to keep the numbers up. But yeah, so like there are niggles. The thing about iOS 12, which is, you know, by far the most popular, like tvOS, there's nothing there because even the new Aero screensavers aren't there. So, you know, I wouldn't even bother doing that one. Mojave is like fine in terms of, I think it's a nice consumer update, but again, there's nothing like that would be niggling at my, you know, I don't even run the Mojave beta just because like that is the thing that I need to rely on the most, and there are, you know, technical reasons and stuff. It's like iOS is the one where you could probably be tempted as an outsider, like not a reporter, not a developer, not anything like that, but it's like, well, these emoji are pretty cool. Animoji are pretty fun. Memoji are pretty interesting. Group notifications, you know, stacking them up together, that's really helpful. You have the... I've seen a lot of people be on, like, Reddit and stuff ask about, like, CarPlay, because obviously in iOS 12, apps like Waze and Google Maps will be integrated with CarPlay, and it's like, should I upgrade to the public beta for it? And things like that, and things like shortcuts as well. Like, a lot of the big features aren't, you know, fully there yet. Like,
yeah, like,
there's no
like
point upgrading to the public beta to use Google Maps and CarPlay, because that relies on more than just the OS update. You also need, you know, the developer to update their app. Mm-hmm. So Google Maps will have to integrate the CarPlay SDK and those, you know, API changes to actually make it work. So, and that won't come until at least, you know, September, when developers are allowed to submit iOS 12 apps to the App Store. And who knows? Waze and Google might not even be there on day one. Like, demoed them at WWDC, but Apple's demoed partnerships before that don't ship for months or don't ship ever. Like, so if you're chomping at the bit for things like that, then there's not even any point to be, you know, tempted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I don't think a lot of people, I mean, understandably, understand that, you know, what CarPlay is a projection of the iPhone software that you're running. You know, basically under the car screen. So like when you update your phone, you update CarPlay, but then you've also got to have the app support. So for like, you're not going to get Waze or Google Maps yet. Other examples of that, like in the past, they showed, it was either Skype or Messenger, Facebook Messenger or both. But they showed like at least Skype as like an example of, a VoIP app that CarPlay can support in like as of like iOS 10. And they've never done that. It's like, you know, I think WhatsApp has supported that feature, but, not like the demo app. So hopefully Google Maps and Waze are actually planning on doing these things, because, like, you know, they're giving them kind of what they need, but yeah, you know, we don't really know. The thing for me is location services are just so wonky, and anything that uses the GPS whenever you're not on Wi-Fi to find your location, it's like maps, navigation, even apps like Pokemon Go that need your location to function really struggle when your location is like way off estimated wise. I saw someone tracking workouts, and like their workout was like all over the map because it's not working in the right way.
Yeah, I think like the it's not fixing the GPS tower until like someone actually makes a request. Like, I think on normal behavior, it's always like passively holding a connection to the GPS place so it can actually locate quickly. Mm-hmm. Whereas now it seems to take like 7 minutes for it to actually hone in on somewhere. So
yeah,
that fix that obviously is clearly a beta problem.
Yeah, over the weekend, I took a trip to my mom's to visit, and she's three hours away. And I always use navigation just to see, like, you know, traffic ahead and ETA and that kind of stuff. And Siri on CarPlay kept chiming in and being, like, rerouting and, like, giving me directions back to the interstate that I was already on. And then also in CarPlay, as a beta 2, if you have accessories like a backup camera or a side camera for blinkers, they just crash CarPlay. Like, that's a developer 2 beta problem, and that's present on iOS 12 public beta 1. So I mean, that's kind of an edge case, I guess, but like if you use CarPlay, then like
important, like navigation.
Yeah, I found that for safety I was just using Bluetooth instead of CarPlay because I wanted to be able to use my blinker without, you know, interrupting like my audio experience and my directions. So yeah, I mean, I'm always cool in this stuff, like hold off, you know, I'm not going to recommend it. And I think is on my wife, she has iOS 12 beta on her phone, just to like try it out and stuff, and no real need for it. And she uses FaceTime a lot, especially with her mom. And anytime you like do multitasking or think that like FaceTime is buggy right now, I guess because there's so much new stuff in FaceTime, you know, 32 people per call, all the Animoji effects and you know, all that stuff. Like, there's a lot of changes there. So it's buggy. It's a buggy app right now. So yeah, if you rely on those things, have a bad time.
Even if you're just having a one-on-one conversation with somebody and you're not using any of the new stickers or, you know, any group calling of any kind, they've changed, like, the interface for FaceTime pretty dramatically.
Yeah,
like,
your phone gets really hot.
Layouts and it kind of works sometimes, and you can actually, like, call an iOS 11 running device and put your Memoji on your head and, you know, kind of get it to work. But yeah, there's definitely rough.
Yeah, so
but
so,
it'll get cleaned out. Like the main problem I'm having is I'm having pretty rough battery life on my phone. Like it will go down within, I'd say, about half as like twice as quickly as it did before.
Yeah,
That gets in the way, you know.
Yeah, I think this year there's a temptation to put iOS 12 beta on like older devices, especially because you do get that performance improvement so that they promised. Like you can see them now, but you also see things like not being optimized for battery life, you know, for various reasons, and all the other bugs.
You literally get the rough with the smooth. Like it can be really like smooth scrolling, but you can still have, you know, battery drain, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then go ahead.
Yeah, one thing I just want to mention on the battery stuff is on developer beta 2, so public beta 1, they changed the battery graphs a bit around, so now they're a bit more legible and easy to see. And they have this new stat now, which is last charge level.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually something that you probably never really thought about, but if you actually want to like check your battery status, it's actually pretty important. It will tell you the date and time of when you last had your phone plugged in and it was charging, and it will show you the percentage of when you unplugged it. So, you know, before it would just say like your iPhone has been plugged in since, you know, has been plugged in since its last full charge, but it wouldn't tell you any of the information. Now you can see, oh, I last charged my phone to 100% on Tuesday at 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then you know, like, oh, from that time, how much has gone down by looking at the current percentage? Similarly, if you plug it in overnight and it didn't actually get up to 100 in the morning, you know, only got up to 75, when you check your battery graphs later, you can see, oh, I actually started the day on 75%, not 100. So it actually helps you get a much more accurate view on how fast your, you know, percentages have actually been falling, because you can now see what it started at, basically.
And I think those charts are on iPad. I was poking around earlier today and I saw some charts on iPad for battery, which the battery health stuff is not on iPad. That's only on the iPhone. But I think the new battery charts, you know, are on iPad.
Yeah.
So that's nice. And then, as always, there's no watchOS beta program, public beta program, just developer beta program. So, you know, we always suspect that the reason for that is that the watch betas are particularly rough, which is true, in that there's no way to roll back the version if you want to opt out of a version, or if you brick your device, then it usually requires some offsite work. So
which has already happened this year, because the first beta was causing problems on certain watches, and people who got bricked watches, they just had to send them off to AppleCare, and you know, they sort them out, or they just replace the hardware or whatever, but still a pain.
Yeah, indeed. So so there's a reason that these are betas, and even a public beta is still a beta. So you know, proceed with caution. Next thing I want to talk about is the Sonos Beam. So this is the smart soundbar that Sonos unveiled 2 days after WWDC's keynote. They sent me one to review. It comes out next month on July 17th. I've had one for a few weeks now to test out. You know, you can kind of read the review, but part of it that I find interesting, discussed here before, is that they didn't replace their old soundbar. It's a new model, kind of lower end than the other one is. So it's really nice for like a bedroom environment or an apartment where you can't really be that loud. But to get like a full surround sound experience out of it, you need to add more Sonos speakers, and it can get very expensive from the $400 starting price. But it like other Sonos speakers now, it's got Amazon Alexa built into it. And the big thing for me that I couldn't review is AirPlay 2. It's going to be a part of the speaker. And, you know, the Sonos One, the Sonos Play 5, and the Sonos Play Bass next month after the speaker comes out. And so I wasn't able to write about the experience with AirPlay 2, but it was there in the beta of the Sonos app. And it totally works. Like, the speaker ships with a HomeKit code on the bottom of it, and in the packaging, like, and to me that was like the most interesting thing about the whole speaker, because like otherwise, like, the price is the most compelling part of it. So for our like next section, I'm going to talk generically about an AirPlay 2 speaker that I've tested, but I'm not saying it's a Sonos Beam, so I can't. You know what I'm saying?
Generic AirPlay 2 speaker manufacturer. You have used an AirPlay 2 speaker.
Because aside from whatever speaker I'm talking about, there's only been HomePod, which is its own thing, and then Apple TV connected speakers. And those are like pushed into the home app, but they're not like HomeKit products in the way that, you know, AirPlay 2 speakers will be. And it was really neat to get to experience, like, what is an AirPlay 2 speaker like? So the way it works is, you know, just like any other HomeKit accessory, has a, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 digit code.
Eight, I think.
Yeah, 8 digit code.
Although now newer accessories can actually use NFC tags. You can just like hold it there and it can scan it.
Yeah, so it's got the old fashioned code that you scan in, and then it, you know, like, you assign it a room in your home app, and it, you know, it has the speaker logo, so it looks different than a HomePod does or an Apple TV does. It's like what they showed at WWDC 2017, and from there it's pretty cool. Like, there are limitations compared to Apple TV or HomePod, because you don't have a built-in Apple Music app or podcast app, so you can't say like, play this on the bedroom speaker and have it play without your iPhone being involved. Really, it's an AirPlay 2 speaker. Like, it's AirPlay from your device to the speaker, no native playback. And there's no Siri built into the speaker, obviously, because that's only available on HomePod. But it works with Siri in your iPhone. So, for example, I could say, you know, hold down the Siri button on my phone and say, play my favorites mix in the bedroom, and it would play on that AirPlay 2 speaker. And what it does is it literally like fires up the music on my iPhone, whatever device I'm using Siri on, and then like initiating AirPlay 2 connection without you needing to like go through and do all the toggling yourself, which is really convenient. Like, it worked great. And then the other thing you can do is you can, you know, tell HomePod also play this in the bedroom to an AirPlay 2 speaker, and it will, you know, do that for you too. And it has all the benefits of like AirPlay 2, where there's the latency is dramatically reduced. It can load the stream far in advance. If you get a phone call or like drop your connection, you know, you can sit out for a few minutes and not have an interruption. And so, you know, I think we've not really seen like the benefit of AirPlay 2 speakers on the market yet, but when these things hit the market, I think they're going to be compelling in a way that AirPlay 1 speakers never really were. Like, they were bad. They were not compelling at all. But just getting to experience an AirPlay 2 speaker, like having it in the home app is cool just anyway. And then all the benefits of, like, you know, AirPlay 2.
Multi-room.
Like, it's really nice. And any speaker that has it, like, it's a compelling feature. So didn't get to mention any of that in my written review of Sonos Beam, because Sonos requested that that it not be discussed.
Probably at Apple's request somewhere along the line.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think they don't have confidence in their beta version of it, but in my experience, you know, whatever I tested was really good. And someone asked me on Twitter, like, you wrote the review and you've got some opinions in there and then some specs, but I didn't really leave with an impression of, like, should I buy this or not? And honestly, like, I want to recommend this as, like, a the soundbar to get, unless you want, like, a high-end home theater soundbar and do, like, some Dolby Atmos stuff. But because I can't say, like, why the AirPlay 2 stuff, then I just put in the review, you know, final thoughts next month. And, you know, so it'll end up being, you know, part of another story whenever AirPlay 2 is from, you know, out from Sonos. But they say in late July, this speaker comes out July 17th. So it's sometime after July 17th and, like, you know, July 30th or whatever it'll be around. So,
so it shows a generic, like, bookcase speaker icon, right?
Mm-hmm, indeed.
What happens when you 3D touch on it and then press the settings button? Like, what options do you get in there? Nothing?
Let's see. So I'm in the home app and I see my speaker there and I'm 3D touching it and you have settings. And it's the same thing. Like, you can give it a name, you give it a room, you can say favorites or not. You see the manufacturer, you see the serial number and the model name, and then you can remove it. So
right, so you're basically getting, like, the HomePod settings screen, but without any of the, you know, I was wondering if they had, like, EQ or music options, you know, integrated into it in the same way if you have, like, a HomePod, you get, like, the sound check toggles and stuff.
Yeah, no, and just, like, you can't do anything special with, like, automation or scenes or anything, you know, yet. That applies there. Maybe whenever the Shortcuts app is out and you can do things with audio, then maybe.
Well,
that,
they
that
haven't
changes.
Confirmed it.
Yeah.
That'd be really nice, but, like, the workflow up today, you can't control, like, AirPlay sources on it. So
no, but you know they showed at least in the keynote firing up audio, like, from it was an NPR radio source that's not in Apple Music. So
yeah, but that plays on the phone.
Yeah. So
maybe. And then you there's no way for, like, you to make a shortcut, even when the Shortcuts app's out or what they announced, to play the audio and change the source from the phone to another speaker.
That's true. Yeah, maybe next year.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of, like, there's so much potential with the Shortcut stuff, but a lot of, like, it's like, as soon as you go beyond the very, very basic thing, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, that's not, you know, that you can see that they're probably going to do it, but it's not there in the shipping version.
Yeah, that's true. On the topic of AirPlay 2 speakers, I did see it was Libertone. I think they're called Zip and, like, Zip Mini, but they have a speaker that is around $300, I think, like $250 and $300 for their two different sizes. But they're Wi-Fi speakers at home, but there's also Bluetooth speakers. So we discussed before, like, you know, will Apple only have AirPlay 2 available in Wi-Fi only speakers, or will there be a version that can be both, like an AirPlay 2 speaker and a Bluetooth speaker that's portable with a battery in it? And the Libertone speakers are both that, like, they've got batteries, and and they've given a date for their update. They say in September it'll be out. So, you know, last year Apple had a big slide of a bunch of partner brands. They've since detailed which specific speakers from those partners, aside from Beats, which is, like, an unannounced speaker that's coming. But it kind of suggests, like, maybe the Beats thing could be, you know, a Wi-Fi speaker for AirPlay 2 and be a portable Bluetooth speaker, you know, which is, like, and if they did anything special with Beats, like somehow integrate Siri without requiring you to use your, you know, iPhone or HomePod or Apple TV to control AirPlay 2, if they had it on device because it's Beats and technically it's Apple, then that would be really compelling because it'd be like a portable HomePod, you know, in a way.
I wonder what they'll do is let you talk to the... Because this kind of seems like a middle ground they might go to, is let you talk to the Beats speaker,
mm-hmm.
but it actually relays the request through the phone.
Yeah, that would be nice. And it would also be nice if AirPlay 2 worked with the Apple Watch. I mean, we know it doesn't work with the Mac, and like that's the Mac for you.
Terrible. Earlier today, I wanted to play something on my Mac, and I went to the menu, and it just says cabin twice in a row. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sad times.
Yeah. You can use it as an iTunes remote controller with a Switch 2 menu for music, but not even podcasts. But it also says this item is not in the Apple Music catalog or whatever. But for the Apple Watch, like, that would be so convenient to be able to walk around. And, like, at that point, it doesn't matter if it has Siri built in or not, because, like, the watch is always on you if you have one. And then you just, like, tell your watch, play this in that room, and it, you know, remotely throws the command. Like, and I get what
AirPlay... it doesn't work.
It doesn't work, though, even with HomePod, even with Apple TV, and especially...
It's so frustrating. Like, the Mac is a separate platform, okay, right? Mm-hmm. I get it. The watch... It loves to kick off to the phone to do stuff.
it requires an iPhone to be set up and to be updated and to do a lot of things. It's not independent yet.
And a feature which you could easily just kick off the controlling to the phone. You just need to say, okay, I've done that on the watch, and that'd be fine. Mm-hmm. Like, you're on the home Wi-Fi anyway to control the speakers, so mm-hmm. your phone's going to be there.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't understand what you're talking about. And it's even more frustrating that now the now playing view... on WatchOS 5 will happily show you all your speakers in your house.
Yeah.
And you can tap on them and make them pause or fast forward and stuff, but you just can't select any of them as actually audio output sources. It's just it's so frustrating and weird.
Yeah, when Jeff Benjamin was working on his video for like top 5 WatchOS 5 features, he had included AirPlay 2, and I was curious like what he meant by that. And he meant that you can see all your AirPlay 2 targets from the now playing. And I think we ended up not including it because it isn't like talk to Siri, control an AirPlay 2 speaker. And it would just be like, you know, talk to Siri in your watch. It tells your iPhone to send the audio over. It's like, okay, cool. But
beyond technical possibility, clearly.
Yeah, alas, it isn't there this year, and maybe next year. I think I wanted to mention before we get away from any of this, you know, all the technology, especially with the watch. We got a lot of feedback on our walkie-talkie discussion last week. Some I really enjoyed, like people with very interesting jobs that are using even the beta in practice now or in theory in the future to replace literal walkie-talkies because they already use walkie-talkies at work to send over like short messages with that. That would be too short and too frequent for a phone call. And so kind of walkie-talkies are what they actually use. And so these people are able to use the watch now in beta for that purpose. So that's a neat way to do things. I think we also got a lot of feedback, like pushback against the idea that walkie-talkies should respect do not disturb, should respect being muted, you know, which I still stand by. And it's like I feel like it will change. It probably won't change before it ships, but like it should, and that whenever it's released, like everyone will have the same, you know, or a majority of the people will have the same thoughts that we had, which is like this is too pervasive to like leave on, and then managing it is an issue. But a lot of the feedback seemed around like the app works like an actual walkie-talkie, which has no do not disturb or mute. It's just on or it's off. Like you're there, or it's not. It's like okay, that's okay, but actual walkie-talkies don't work across continents. And
they're not strapped to your wrist all day long.
And this walkie-talkie allows you and I to talk to each other from the US and the UK, so they can afford some not realistic, you know,
like technology enables you to take the best things of analog communication and you know do them better. Like you don't have to recreate these things one to one to actually make them make sense. Like I mean, email is a perfect example, right? It's sending letters, but you don't have to wait for them to get there. Like,
yeah.
Like you adapt to the, you know, to what you have. And like, yes, it mirrors how a walkie-talkie works, but that doesn't make it perfectly appropriate. And I think it's really cool to hear about like, you know, people using them in theaters and stuff like that. And it's like, sure, but there you're using your walkie-talkie for like your job, and then you leave you leave it wherever you are, and then you go away. Or you're limited by the range, right? So say if your boss at the restaurant has a walkie-talkie in the restaurant and you take your walkie-talkie in your pocket home with you to your home, you're going to be out of range. Like, it's not going to make any noise anymore, almost naturally. Whereas with the watch, the watch's walkie-talkie app, like, because it works over the internet, it's like boundless. Like, you can, if you have yourself on and available, you know, anyone can talk to you any time of the day, whether they're next to you, near you, or on the other side of the world. Like, there's very different parameters about how it should be designed and how it should work.
Yeah. So this is one of the things in like watchOS 5 beta 3, maybe out next week. We'll see. It's one of the things I want to test, you know, early on is do they change any of those settings? Because I think they ought to. And then it's,
yeah. And I think somebody said to us, well, maybe it's just like a beta bug that it doesn't respect the do not disturb setting. It's like, I think it's clearly they've intentionally made it so that it overrides those options, because it's clearly based on FaceTime audio, and when you make phone calls, it doesn't, you know, ring over the top of those options.
Yeah.
And this has clearly been made in a way that it doesn't respect mute, it doesn't respect theater mode, it doesn't respect do not disturb. And like, I think that's fine if you want to offer a preference for it. You know, like, walkie-talkie works with the ringer switch all the time, in the same way you can have options for how Siri talks to you on, you know, on Apple Watch Series 3.
Like, yeah,
you can have it never speak to you, you can have it speak with the mute, or you can speak
with headphones
all the time. Like, there's obviously there's a, depending on your exact use case, obviously there's going to be different options, but I think for the vast majority of people, the way you just want to use it as a casual chit chat, not for like an industrial or enterprise use, the current way it works isn't good enough.
Yeah, what I do think is a bug, just how it all works, is I tried walkie-talkieing my wife, who, you know, lets me add her on walkie-talkie with no indication that she's not on the beta or on WatchOS 5, and then I can send her a message, and like I mentioned last week, that I thought was happening, it makes her phone ring like a phone call. She couldn't answer it. But it like literally made her phone ring for me to just send like a hello message, you know, through walkie-talkie. So, and I don't know if that's because she's on iOS 12, you know, if that would do nothing on like iOS 11. I'm curious if that changes too between now and launch. Because I think there should be some indication that this person has the feature as an option. That way you don't end up accidentally calling people. Because that's a pretty big deal to make someone's phone ring and then not be able to answer it, and you not realize on your end that that's what you did, you know? Because otherwise, it's like with iMessage. You can't iMessage someone who doesn't have it. Like, they're just not available.
It doesn't, like, send them a blank text instead.
Yeah. Or make their phone ring. So some growing pains there. But, I mean, it wasn't in the first beta. It was only in the second beta. So I think there's plenty of room to grow. I just hope that Apple takes – and another thing, feedback in the beta period is very important. Like, there are so many examples of – not even like based on radars, but just like based on public discussion on Twitter and on podcast about like, this is how I think this should work. This is a problem I have with it. Like, major changes. Like remember one was during some betas, like several beta versions, Apple Pencil would only draw, like it wouldn't move things around. Another thing is how messed up notifications were with iOS 11 before they changed the way it, you know, worked. All of those things changed, I think, because of like online discussion and not necessarily like the number of radars filed, you know, for the changes. So
yeah, radars are important, but it's not like the only barometer of thing. And that's why I'm still on a campaign to get this photo camera roll button moved, like in Messages.
Yeah.
You have to dig into an iMessage app to send photos from your camera roll, and it kills me every single time.
I think that's universal too, that everyone believes that it's located in a worse place. Like, the actual app is better, that you can do a lot more things now with the photo picker. And I like that you can open the photo picker without seeing like your viewfinder on the camera, because I'm always afraid I'm going to send something that I don't want to send. But everyone agrees that the tap zigzag finding it is not good. And for a lot of people, they just don't know where it is. It's like, did they remove the photos option to share photos, you know? So yeah.
When this comes out, if it comes out in this state, I'll get plenty of people in my family. Where do I send a picture? Oh, you press the App Store icon. What?
Like, obviously.
Like, people don't associate the Photos app as an app. Like, you just think of it as your photos, because you don't have to go and download it from the App Store. It's just there. But
yeah,
like, you press this, then you press it. Like, even if they don't want to, like, it's not far-fetched for the iMessage bar with the text edit field into it to have three buttons. It could have a camera icon, it could have a photo library icon, and it could have the App Store icon. And before everyone goes crazy about, oh, they couldn't fit three icons down there, it's only a couple of years ago when that's exactly how it worked. You had three icons in that on the left-hand side.
Good days.
And it was perfectly fine.
Good days. Yep. All right, let's talk about MacBook keyboards. This is something we really haven't discussed like regularly on this podcast, but you know, it's the whole issue of, since the original 12-inch MacBook, when these Apple switched to the butterfly keyboard style, that's you know, very low travel, very thin, moved it to the MacBook Pro line as well.
We talked about this 2 years ago when it's an issue, and 2 years later, it's still an issue.
Yeah, like in 2015, and now we're in 2018. So, what was it, like Friday night? It was like Friday at 5 p.m. Were you Barry News? Apple had announced, or maybe it was on Thursday, I don't know, but it was last week. Apple announced a repair program for basically every MacBook with the butterfly keyboard style. You get 4 years of support from the day that you buy it. And so if you have the old 12-inch MacBook, then that's like 1 year from now if you bought it at launch. And that's my wife's computer, by the way. Like, she's got the gold 12-inch MacBook, and her keyboard is a mess from like light usage. And so we're going to take advantage of this program where they apparently replace the keyboard. And I think that encompasses other parts too, like your trackpad and maybe battery.
They say they may replace keycaps only, or they may do like a full top case replacement, which includes like the trackpad and the whole, you know, everything you see on it, basically.
Yeah, and if you paid for past repairs, you can apply for a refund if you think that you've paid for a repair that would be covered by this program. The big mystery here that Apple doesn't want to answer is, are they using some new technique or new design here? Like, it's clearly still the same butterfly keyboard style, but did they do something different to make it not happen again? My guess is no, that they're literally just resetting the clock on these keyboards. And like, if you had a problem before, it will happen again. I haven't had my keyboard replaced yet. I'm going to, just because I think it needs to be done. But it's literally every like modern computer that they make, except for the MacBook Air, which has the old keyboard style, and the 2015 MacBook Pro.
And that's only because they haven't updated the MacBook Air. Hey,
right,
that's a different, that's a different tunnel. Like, the proposition has gone from, you can buy a MacBook Pro. I always say MacBook Pro just because it's the one I always buy. But you can buy a MacBook and you can risk your keys breaking or sticking. And you can go into an Apple store and fight for them to fix it, or be forced to pay for it. The proposition now is, you can buy a MacBook Pro, still fear that your keys will break and stick, but in the knowledge you can go in the Apple store and they should replace it without argument, because now they've this specific program for it. And it's not like, oh, we're doing it low key, you know, like how they had Staingate, where you'd have the blotch come up on the screen, but they never did like a public announcement for it. It was just, this was an internal thing they sent out to the geniuses. This is like a public thing, so you can show someone the URL if you really have to. You can do mail-in repair. Like, you don't have to go into the store if you can't get there. But like, the situation isn't much better, in my opinion. It's gone from, this is really, really bad, to this is how it always should have been, in that there was a fault with the keyboards and now they'll fix them for free. Like, I when this went out on Friday, I tweeted, I said, like, this is weird timing, but okay. And I didn't mean weird timings in it's on Friday, because, you know, that's like the dead time for bad news, so it makes perfect sense. What I meant was, is like, I wasn't expecting a repair program until they had a new keyboard, like a third generation butterfly keyboard that actually addressed the issue. Because for all intents and purposes, it doesn't seem like this repair program changes the keys. It brings them to the 2017 models, which have slightly modified rubber gaskets than the 2016 ones. So it definitely seems like the 2017 is better and more reliable than the 2016, but still not anywhere close to perfect or as good as the older keyboard style. But there's no big technological design change here. It's just like, oh, now we'll make sure we repair it if it breaks. So it's still not, I can't really give it like, I can't, you know, oh, Apple, you're so great for doing this. It's like the bare minimum.
I mean, we are totally waiting for the first story to pop up of someone who had their keyboard repaired, whether it be us or someone else, and then had the exact same issue, you know, like within no time, because it's just, I think they're just resetting the clock. Like, maybe if someone knows, let us know. You know, like, I think best case scenario is they're upgrading all the keyboards with gaskets now that weren't there before. The thing is, like, the 12-inch MacBooks, I don't think they ever had that before. The MacBook Pros, the first generations didn't have gaskets, and the second ones did. But then I'm not even sure that there's a, like, that those are, you know, much better. Because it's like, part of it is that debris, like the least amount of debris can affect the keyboard. You're not going to change like the travel. Like, this is what we have now. That's a whole other issue than like how reliable it is.
The travel's great. Like,
I agree.
The keyboard's great apart from when it doesn't work.
I agree. I use a 12-inch MacBook right now, and I think it's even, you know, less travel than the MacBook Pros have, and I'm perfectly happy with it. Like, it's, if the keyboard was you know, never had keys feel sticky, you know, like if a crumb gets in the keyboard, something, you know, dust, whatever, didn't make a key feel like you had like glue in it, then I would love the keyboard. Like, it almost feels like it's solid state. Like, there's no moving parts to it, and that makes it feel reliable to me. And like if the keys were like simulated, you know, haptic feedback, and it really didn't move, it's what it kind of feels like. But the fact is, it's just like, it is not solid state. These are moving parts, and there's very little room for things to move around inside. And so, you know, maybe they've improved that. You know, another issue.
Also, there's logistics issues here. Like, there are different strands of the sticky keys problem. Like,
yeah,
there's people who have keys that literally break and never work again. Obviously, that's a fault. And then there's people like me, who I have the 2016, but doesn't really make a difference. Everyone's on the same boat, unless you're on a MacBook Air. You press a key and it'll be fine, and then like a month goes by, and then one of your keys gets stuck down, and if you try hard enough, you can get it back to normal again, normally by like bashing it for about a minute, and then it dislodges whatever's stuck there, and it goes back to normal. And then you can go another couple of months, and then you'll have another key stick down. It's clearly not, you know, correct, but it's not a persistent issue. And if I take my MacBook Pro in for service tomorrow, I think there's a good chance they give it back to me with nothing changed at all, because they'll find no fault.
Yeah. The
and
trick
like,
is
to
have...
to
have
just wait carefully until a key gets stuck and then quickly rush to the Apple store. Or like, if I wouldn't even risk doing a mailing repair, because I want them to verify, you know, while I'm there standing with them, that exactly they're actually going to do something about it. Because, like, mine is not a, oh, my space bar never works. It's a, every 2 months, I smack a key until it starts working again.
Yeah, I will notice that my shift or command or option key or arrow key or space bar, like something about it, it needs a little bit more pressure to work. And like, that's the issue. I love the way that they frame this here. They say Apple has determined that a small percentage of the keyboards in certain MacBook and MacBook Pro models may exhibit one or more of the following behaviors. Letters or characters repeat unexpectedly. Letters or characters do not appear. Keys feel sticky or do not respond in a consistent manner. So a small percentage of certain MacBook and MacBook Pros, but then it's literally every MacBook and MacBook Pro with this keyboard style. Now, the small percentage thing is
only
like...
Only a small percentage of...
It's like... I can believe that they have data that says that a small number of how many they sold come back with issues. But that's, I mean, I've had two of these MacBooks now, MacBook Pro and then MacBook. Well, I guess three now, really, because it's MacBook, MacBook Pro, and MacBook. All three have had the sensitivity issue to debris. And I've never reported it to Apple because there's never been a clear indication that they're going to do anything about it, you know. Now I will, in the hopes that there's some more, you know, resistant keyboard that they're going to insert. But
well, you're going to do it now because you know they'll actually do something for free.
Yeah.
Whereas before, you could take it, you know, slug it along, bring it to them, and they would say, okay, that's going to cost you $500 if it was outside of warranty and you know Apple Care. Like,
yeah.
So at least the price tag ridiculousness has gone away.
Yeah.
But I don't think the time frame is very generous. Like, especially on the 2015 MacBook Pro, they say on the MacBook 12-inch MacBook, you get 4 years after you bought it. So if you bought a 12-inch MacBook at launch, you know, the clock's ticking.
That was April. It was like, I think it was April 2015, maybe March 2015. So then you've really got until like March or April 2019. So you've kind of got the next year to figure this out and hope
not
that...
Not great to me. Like, and a lot of these programs, get extended. Like,
yeah.
They just say, we'll carry them on for some more time. Mm-hmm. But the real thing is here, the MacBook, the next generation of MacBook updates have surely got to use a keyboard that doesn't exhibit these problems that Apple have identified in a repair program.
Yeah.
Because that'd just be ridiculous. Like, they can't bring out a keyboard that they know has these issues.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they still sell most of the computers on this list today. They're selling computers that are part of a repair program, a service program.
And as far as we know, they haven't changed how the keyboards are made. So every Mac laptop, apart from the Airs, sold from now until they change any of them, theoretically can exhibit these issues. I guess they say that their stance will be, it's not every Mac. It's only a small percentage of them.
Yeah, which I think that they can manipulate, you know, however you want to frame it. They can use data to show that based on selling X number of computers and only certain ones come back with problems. I think that everyone they sell can have this problem, that it's by design. It's not a flaw in, like, some of them off the factory line. It's just, are people using them in environments where debris is a problem? Are people using them in environments or are they using them and having issues that they think are worth reporting? Because even for me, like, knowing that there's a free repair program now, you know, best case scenario is I probably need to borrow a computer early next week because I need to have this thing taken to an Apple store. I'm going on Saturday. We heard over the weekend, last weekend, that someone had 2 days turnaround time. They went on Friday night and got it back on Sunday. So I need my computer back on Monday morning. I'll probably need to borrow one in the meantime. And
I mean, Apple promises 5 to 7 days.
Yeah, exactly. So even so, like, the chance that I might have to say I can't wait that long. And so does that get reported to Apple? And if I decided I just don't even need to risk it, then it doesn't really get reported to Apple. So it's a very curious situation. And it's good that they're finally discussing it, like, acknowledging it. But, you know, it's a big question mark until we find out, you know, A, are the repairs some new style that is resistant to debris? And then B, will there be new models this year, next year, that change the style in some way? So we'll see.
Yeah, it's still a very – I would say very little has changed between now and a month ago when we were talking, you know, when – because this always comes up now. Every few months, everyone gets to complain about the keyboards. Rightly so, because it's pretty embarrassing that they mm-hmm. have these problems. And, you know, that a huge number of the people that report these issues on Twitter and stuff are journalists. So maybe they're the ones that stress test these keyboards the most. And part of the reason it's a small percentage is that most people don't use their keyboards as much as, you know, like we would. But
yeah.
Regardless, it's bad. It's a bad shape, but this isn't a solution. This is just a nice gesture at most, or yeah. a minimum. Is Apple doing the bare minimum of what they should be doing, right?
Yeah, like, it's not the end of the story, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not running around giving Apple a pat on the back for this. This is like what they should have done 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this. I am in a situation right now where I've sold my iMac, and... you know, as part of it is like it just deciding like what is the best computer for me. So I had a 15-inch MacBook Pro and then decided I wanted a desktop and a portable laptop. So I had a 27-inch iMac 5K and then I have the 12-inch MacBook. And a few months ago, I decided to sell the iMac and go MacBook only and then buy like whatever new MacBook comes out this year or next year. And there's a temptation to buy a faster computer sooner, but this has become such a known issue for me that I'm not going to buy anything right now until there's a change. Like, you know, that's what I'm waiting for. All right, let's talk about Bloomberg's streak of stories this week to wrap up. So first is a story from Mark Gurman about a lot of audio products from Apple this year and next. Premium AirPods, next-gen HomePod, over your Apple headphones that you've heard about, and then another set of AirPods. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I think the biggest news here is that it seems like Apple's going to split the AirPods up into like an actual product range with an entry model and then like a pro model. So, and features like Hello Siri and better water resistance were reported by Mark before, and now there's a bit more clarity. It seems that later this year, Apple will do second generation AirPods that are replace the upgrade on the current models, which will include a new chip to support Hello Siri, so you don't have to double tap to talk to Siri. You can just speak out the hot word and talk, which will be a nice forward update. I'm assuming that when those come out, it will also be alongside the wireless charging case stuff. But then also, what this report claims is that Apple's going to be releasing a higher-end AirPods variant with additional features like a slightly better noise cancellation, water resistance marketed to help for like sweat and stuff like that. So, but these would be presumably more expensive. Or, and the report doesn't go into detail here, but maybe the current AirPods come down slightly and these replace it in the 159. The details here are still like up in the air a bit, but it's like, it's kind of weird for me to imagine Apple doing like two separate lines of AirPods, like AirPods and AirPods Pro, especially when the features don't seem that distinct. Like, I'm assuming there's going to be more differences than just one has slightly better water resistance.
Yeah, to me, it sounds like AirPods and AirPods Sport, which I can kind of get behind. If you're like, these are the AirPods for like general purpose consumption and they've got, you know, certain features, and then these are a little bit more expensive, and if you use them for exercising, you're going to want these, you know. I've actually had no issue with using AirPods that we have today with running and getting very sweaty, even in rain, which is not ideal. I was worried, but I have seen people that have had AirPods needed to be replaced because of those issues. So it is a point that needs to be addressed. I just think that, you know, you can, I kind of agree with you that it sounds weird to have a line with these being the differences and not more dramatic differences. Especially when Apple, like, water resistance seems to be going through all of Apple's line. So if they can do a, I don't know if it's a major difference in production cost anyway.
Yeah, like the current AirPods seem pretty okay for water resistance stuff. And it specifically mentions you won't be able to go with like swimming with them. So it won't be, you know, IP68 like the Apple Watch. It would still be, you know, more just for sweat and rain. But obviously everyone's been using AirPods for 2 years now and in those kind of situations and mostly not having an issue. So it's a weird thing to like diversify on. So I think there's more to that kind of product portfolio that we haven't got clarity on yet, but it's interesting that they're going to really hammer home on that stuff. Although it makes sense given how popular AirPods have been and clearly surprised Apple, they still struggle to have them in stock. And part of this report is that Apple's moving away from Inventec, which makes AirPods and HomePods at the moment, and they're expanding the supply chain to also include like Foxconn and stuff to make, which probably represents a more serious effort at like doing audio products, because Foxconn's obviously the same company that assembles iPhones and stuff, whereas Inventec was this like smaller firm. So there's hopefully going to be more availability of these things as they, you know, ramp up and improve them. The over-ear Apple branded headphones, which Ming-Chi Kuo talked about earlier in the year, are concurred here, but apparently they faced development problems, so they're not coming out at the end of this year as originally planned. They will come out in 2019. They're considered a more premium option over the Beats product, and whenever I hear more premium, I think more expensive, so have fun with that. And Apple is making a second generation HomePod for a launch as soon as early 2019.
And those are all the details for that, for HomePod 2.
That is what is reported. There is a new one on the way, which I know some people like laughed at, like, oh, there's no information there. The fact they're even working on one so soon is kind of substantial to me. Like, I'm pretty sure when the HomePod came out, I said it's probably going to start this for a while. Like, I think I was dead set on them adding to the range with a, you know, a mini model or however you want to make an alternative variant. But the base HomePod, I was probably pretty convinced that they were just going to keep it around for longer. You know, like how the AirPods have, right? They haven't refreshed them on a year-by-year basis. They've stuck around, and they bob along. Like, although it is kind of, it's like the HomePod blurs the line between like real product and accessory, but it just didn't feel like critical for them to have an immediate 1 year later update. But apparently this is what's going to happen. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of hope that it is still that there's some different, it's not the successor, but it's in addition to the current HomePod. I think there is some room for variety there in terms of, you know, size and price.
I mean, they could do both, right? They could have a mini and a new major update to the original.
I mean, I think there's probably, I think that the current one could do well with a price cut, in that there could be room for a higher end HomePod. Like, I really want to have like little satellite HomePods everywhere, you know, like Echo Dot style. I just don't see that happening anytime soon. But what I could see Apple doing is saying like, this is HomePod, you know, and this is like HomePod Plus with a even better sound, you know, and have like a model for $299, have a model for like $599, you know, like or $499, I don't know, but.
Yeah, my list of things about making the HomePod more appealing is all about software capabilities.
Totally, yeah.
And a price cut. Like, I think they could carry on with this hardware for a while and be perfectly fine, assuming they made it a bit cheaper and they add in stuff like phone calls natively, multiple timers, all that baloney that isn't even sophisticated assistant stuff. It's just like, you know, flesh out the basics. And hey, we've got calendaring now, so...
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Yeah, I mean, like, zoom out from all this, and I'm eager to have the features of AirPods and over ear headphones that are quality. I like the Bose QC35s, and I like the Beats Studio headphones. And you can even get studio headphones that have like AirPods kind of features where it pairs and switches fast, but you don't get things like take them off your head and the audio pauses like you do with AirPods. And that's something that I think would be nice. But next year, I guess, maybe. with the AirPods thing is confusing because it's like, if there's a line, then you need to decide like which ones are right for you, and then there's some coming this year, we think, and then some coming next year. You know, that's confusing. The idea of having AirPods that you can talk to Siri with without tapping anything, just by voice, I think is welcome. It will be very useful, as we discussed before. But then having like multiple units, I'm confused by that. So I really can't say, you know, until we know more about that.
Yeah, I think we need to learn more about that stuff through leaks before we can make a judgment on it, really.
Yeah. The next thing came from Bloomberg this week is an attempt at explaining what's happening with AirPower. And frankly, like, from my perspective, it's kind of like anything you could imagine is going wrong is in this report. Because I think that the description was like why Apple's taking so long to, you know, release AirPower. And the takeaways were all things like
basically ran the gamut. You had overheating, complex circuitry, firmware's not done, you know, product is unreliable. Like, it was just, it kind of like all the bases were covered on potential reasons for it being taking time together.
Yeah. And then there were some new nuggets, things like saying that it runs a scaled down variant of iOS.
Which really probably just means like the low level firmware is the same kind of XCNU base as thing. And it reminds me of like the Lightning AV adapter, which has its own little chip on it. Like, it just makes it the reason on the AirPower Mac needs like a more advanced brain than, you know, a Belkin or a Mophie Qi charger is to coordinate the way the coils work and undecide and deploy the circuitry to support, you know, three devices, different devices, two phones, watch in different spots. To coordinate all that stuff, it needs like power management technology. And it just makes sense. You know, just put an old Apple chip in there and it can do it. Like, I think the best takeaway from this report was that it said AirPower mats are now being used in offices, in engineers' offices at campus, which must mean it's cleared safety issues and it's getting close to actually coming out, because they couldn't put it in like you know, just a day-to-day test, not the offices that they're developing the product in, but just like you're just testing it as a you know, an alpha test essentially, yeah, internally. Like, it couldn't get to that stage unless it was, you know, close to ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I mean, there's been so much room for speculation about all of this that, you know, I think we've been drenched in people's thoughts on like what's happening and what's going to happen. My view of it is that when they did the sneak peek last year, that they probably thought they'd have it out in the first 6 months, but they obviously didn't know, so they left room for, you know, what we see now, which is it could be the second half of the year. This report says that they are not targeting by September, which could mean sooner or in September. I still wouldn't be surprised if it's like after September, like, you know,
point it doesn't even matter. Like,
yeah, it's like we could see here in November or October that they need a little more time and it's going to be a 2019 product, you know, like that has happened with so many things and this would just
and
be
then it will actually be late because then everyone calls AirPower late. But, you know, if you're following the book of when Apple announced the release date, they've got the entire of 2018 to do it.
Yeah, you just need to read really closely into like what Apple said historically to have a takeaway, which you know we do, but I understand why people are frustrated about it. The thing is that I totally expect it to be like what they promised, and I think that whenever they announced it, that they had like, you know, I wasn't at the event, Jordan was, but he, you know, there were mats you could take photos of that were charging things, like, and I don't think it was that simulated, so I think they were, you know. They were not like – they didn't just have the idea for like a Kickstarter. They were like, we're going to
– Yeah, those demo units they had there, you could like lift them up and they would stop charging and you could put a phone back down and it would start charging you again.
Yeah, like, it was like –
they quote-unquote worked.
Yeah, it was like in a demonstration state. It's just like the final touches is what's so hard for so many Apple products lately. So it'll happen when it happens. But
I'm looking forward to getting one. I think things like complex circuitry and – runs a stripped down version of iOS. If you're expecting this to be cheap, I would put those.
Yeah, I've had my $200 set aside for months now. It's cool. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I hope it's a bit cheaper than that, because then I can't bear the complaints everyone's going to have about it. But like, and I think at $200, it's really going to struggle to be like a big seller. Like, it needs to be a slightly more accessible than that, but. Who knows? They never announced a price, I think, on purpose.
Yeah, I could.
They probably weren't entirely sure how much they could charge for it.
That's true. I could honestly see like $180 plus the cost of the optional AirPods charging case, unless you buy new AirPods, you know, in the future that come with it. But in terms of like, it's going to work with the iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, iPhone 10, and any newer iPhones, Apple Watch Series 3, and that charging case. Like, I don't think they need to like retract any of that. I think it's going to. You know what they showed, like, so far, they could release it and they wouldn't need to like offer any apology or correction. It's like, it is what it is, you know, just not what we want. And then also in that report, Mark Gurman included a detail that said that they in the making of the iPhone 10, they at one point considered having no lightning port, just relying on wireless charging. I don't think there was any weight behind like how serious that was, or, you know. And I think it's easy to imagine that's like a goal eventually that you can have, like you have with the Apple Watch, and the newer Apple TV, you know, you remove ports, you get by without it. You know, you have maybe some way to service otherwise without like an external port for customers. And there's so many things that, you know, like, wireless CarPlay, wireless charging, wireless headphones, like you could have that be one of the iPhones, and in the future you could even see like wireless stuff is cheap to, you know, and as prevalent as wired stuff is today. I don't think we're close to that yet, but I think it's possible, like in the long view.
Yeah, I think a lot of people jumped on that line, but I think there's a reason that Gurman wrote it as a line in a bigger report versus doing a dedicated story on it. Like, I'm sure every single time Jony Ive is tasked with designing a new chassis for an iPhone, he examines every single port on that thing, and like the team tries to work out ways to simplify and get rid of stuff. And it's like, I'm surprised the mute switch is still around. Like,
me too. Yeah, me too.
But yeah, I'm sure they'll get rid of the charging ports eventually, but they've too much of an ecosystem to drop all ports at the moment. Like, it's a gradual thing. They don't even have an a first-party wireless charger out the door yet. So,
well, they needed to switch to USB-C before they dropped the port altogether. So we have a lot of phases to get through first. I think the USB-C switch is more likely than dropping the port next year, you know, that kind of thing. So
yeah, I'd agree with that.
Not that the report claimed that they were going to drop the port next year. It was just floated that it was on the table for the iPhone X design. And then also in this space, our old friend Ming-Chi Kuo, the supply chain analyst with an honorable track record, formerly of KGI Securities, has resurfaced at the less catchy TF International Securities, with a report that kind of just reiterates like things that he said at KGI, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of his like, welcome, I'm at my new place now. I need to establish the baseline of the stuff that you should be thinking about, investors. That's kind of how the takeaway.
Yeah, he had one previous report that was from TF International Securities, TFIS. That was about, I think, the pricing for all of the iPhone models this year. This one was more of just like a multi-point breakdown of like predictions specifically about the 6.1-inch LCD iPhone cost, and you know, he may even talked about things like trade war with China, you know, based on like the administration's policies, and he predicts that it would be indirect effects to Apple, but that possibly Apple's brand could be damaged as an American company in China, and that's more of a risk. In the end, it was like predicting, you know, products that we'll see this year, iPad Pros, the Face ID, the Apple Watch with a larger display, a cheaper MacBook Air, like all things that have been on the table, just like saying it at TF International Securities. And it started out with like a kind of a weird little bubble of information, which was about next year's iPhones. Like his line was that right now there's no information, but that he expects it to be an innovative change based on history. But that he thinks he'll know more by September or October. So it's like, okay, teaser. It's like, you know.
If that was a random analyst, you'd just laugh at him, but he's got a track record of getting next year's phones before the new ones come out.
Right. So, and he also said in this note that the 6.1-inch, you know, iPhone, because they'll have this iPhone X style, but the LCD, that they'll be harder to manufacture. He said to expect production later in the year, but also to expect them to be sold in stores in September. So, you know, when we see the inevitable reports about, you know, production pushback, production difficulties, phone could be late, you know, it might not happen like that this year. That like last year we had the iPhone X be 2 months later than the other phones in September. Sounds like this year, September, for all the new phones.
Yeah, we've already heard about some like LCD production quality, you know, quality assurance stuff, but the overwhelming theme was that Apple's getting suppliers to ramp up earlier to not have a repeat of last year where their flagship phone was, you know, effectively delayed, even though they would never say that. But clearly they wanted it out in September. Yeah. So I think there's a real concerted effort this time around to get everything going earlier.
It came out a month and a half or 2 months after it was announced, you know, by the announcement. But still, you know, there's a reason they don't announce the September iPhones in July, you know, so. And then something else that we observed this week, I think that happened this month probably, is that Apple discontinued the modern buckle band for the Apple Watch. This is the first time we've seen one of the original Apple Watch styles disappear totally. We've seen previously, obviously, colors go away, colors based on season. And we've seen the link bracelet no longer sold as a configuration of the watch. Like you had to buy the link bracelet separately always. And to me, I think it's largely because the watch does so well as a fitness tracker, and they add things like actual waterproofing and swim tracking. So the leather bands as a default configuration, even the metal bands, you know, like right now your only options are classic buckle or the Milanese loop. I think it's because the sport ones and the nylon ones, the water resistant ones that are comfortable to, you know, in exercise, just are fit Apple's vision of the watch now.
Yeah, like things like the modern buckle are kind of relics of the mindset of the Apple Watch Gold edition. Like,
yeah,
all of that wave includes like the more, you know, artisanal,
well, Well, and I think they also can fit in. I mean, they always had sold gold editions with sport bands with the gold pens, and you know they sell the current ceramic editions with ceramic pens. Like the sport bands are actually quite nice. That they're not so. Even though they're options on the lower end models, I think they're nicer than like nylon bands. You know, they can pull it off. A couple of things here too is that. I think the modern buckle has the classic buckle has changed the clasp style from being like a small oval to like this round erect kind of style. It isn't like a buckle like modern buckle was, but it's a similar shape. So I think there was some overlap there, and it was just like, you know, get rid of this thing. I think it's been out of stock for a long time. They just eventually just like stopped even listing it. But then
on the day that we covered the report, you could buy one configuration on the UK Apple Store of the modern buckle.
Uh-huh.
And then it's gone now.
It's gone now, yeah.
It's getting zapped from existence.
Yeah.
I always thought all the bands they made and designed were really cool and, like, interesting, but equally at the same time, I never bought any of them. And I can't imagine they're, you know, big, big sellers. Like, and they don't fit into the modern, you know, streamline main watch purpose, which is fitness stuff, right? Like, so it makes sense that they're going to slim down the range somewhat. But I hope it's not like... I hope Apple doesn't give up making cool, like, actual, you know, watches and not just servicing, you know, the fitness tracker of the market.
Me too. You know, one thing they do with the Hermes bands, because those are all leather bands, is not if you buy it separately, but if you buy the Hermes watch with the Hermes watch faces, you always get an orange Hermes sport band too. That way, you know, you're spending a lot of money on the Hermes watch anyway. And that way you don't have to buy a separate sport band and you get like the exclusive Hermes sport band. I mean, that would be fine, I think. But then my aunt had this first modern buckle, like the light pink one, when she bought her first generation Apple Watch. And then she bought a sport band like for the gym, and she just never wore the modern buckle one. And even like when she dressed up, you know, I think the sport band like kind of just fits in any situation.
Yeah, the sport band's good enough, and it's too much of a hassle to change bands, I think.
It is, like, yeah, it is.
If you go out in the day and you're doing like a daily workout, and then, you know, you really don't want to go in the evening and then change the band around to a different, you know, like a fancier one. Like, it's so much easier just to have one band.
I have a lot of bands, so I change like maybe once a week that often. But I could never get in the habit of like, I'm always going to wear a leather or metal band, but then only have a sport band during exercise for half an hour a day. Like that, it's easy to change bands, but it's not. It's too much, to do that. So RIP, and then your theory is that it's the shape of the band or the shape of
well,
the metal.
Well, this is a possible theory in that the modern buckle's clasp matches. It kind of mirrors the watch size, and as Quo. Formerly of KGI Securities, continues to say the Apple Watch Series 4 will be getting a bigger screen, which means some kind of form factor change, and that would make the bottom buckle invalidated in the way it looks. So I think if it wasn't going to be discontinued today, it would have been discontinued in a couple of months. So they're just kind of clearing out the stock when they can.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons to this. We'll see. Maybe there'll be a new modern buckle with a new shape.
A postmodern buckle.
Postmodern buckle. All right. Well, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at ApolloZach, and also on Instagram as at ApolloZach. And Benjamin, you are?
I'm BZAMayo on Twitter and not on Instagram.
And you can email us at happyhour@95mac.com. That being said, we'll be back this week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.